This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Brian Check, founder of the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy, or CASE, the leading organization promoting the transition from unsustainable growth to a new economic paradigm. Brian is also a visiting professor at Virginia Tech, where he teaches ecological economics, and is author of the books Shoveling Fuel for a Runaway Train, which calls for an end to uneconomic growth, and The Endangered Species Act, History, Conservation, Biology, and Public Policy. Brian Check is here today to tell us about his most recent book, Supply Shock, Economic Growth at the Crossroads and the Steady State Solution, and to argue that a steady state economy is the best road to environmental protection. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you, Diane.
Why is economic growth a bad goal for the 21st century?
Well, because we just can't have it forever. You know, there's a limit to growth based on the environmental requirements for economic growth. And all the time that the economy is growing, it's kind of eating away at the environment, at the natural capital and the funds of ecosystem services. It's sort of taking the money out of the bank that our kids and grandkids will need for their economy. I think it helps to remind listeners exactly what economic growth is. You know, there's nothing magical about it. It's simply increasing production and consumption of goods and services in the aggregate. And so that means it entails an increasing human population and per capita production and consumption. And, of course, it's measured by GDP, or gross domestic product. And that's it. You know, it's increasing production and consumption in the aggregate. And that's a key phrase. So it's not just, say, growing the solar panel sector while fossil fuel sector declines, theoretically. That would be a sectoral readjustment. Economic growth is the whole integrated economy growing.
Well, as an alternative, you speak about the steady state economy. Would you remind us, what is a steady state economy?
Well, the best way to look at the definition of that is to go back to our definition of economic growth, increasing production and consumption of goods and services in the aggregate. So a steady state economy, instead of increasing production and consumption, is stabilized. And of course, it's not flatlined. That would be impossible, but it's a stabilized, mildly fluctuating, preferably around an optimum level. You know, if you hear some people talk sometimes about maximum sustainable level, well, the maximum sustainable level, that's not necessarily a nice level either for all of the other things that we strive for in a healthy society. So the ideal steady state economy is that at an optimal level with all other things considered.
You have argued that climate change is the wrong top priority for environmentalists, and that addressing economic growth and moving to a steady state economy should be the top priority instead. Would you explain?
Well, sure. Yeah, that stems from an article on the Huffington Post recently. And if you recall, I sort of doubled down on the disclaimers right at the beginning of that article, because I don't want anyone thinking that climate change is not a very important issue. It certainly is, and it's an issue that I'm very familiar with, having to work on climate change planning for much of my career in the past couple decades. So I think, you know, in a good position to assess the relative merits of prioritizing that versus the issue of unsustainable economic growth. The problem with prioritizing climate change is that even though the science is plentiful and sufficient to establish the causes and effects of climate change, it's not so easy for the public to deal with all of the uncertainties that climate change science has to deal with. Climate change isn't something that you can see with your own two eyes. You know, you can see some of the effects of climate change, but one particular weather event, as the meteorologists and climate scientists tell us over and over again, does not climate change make. So when that hurricane happens, was that a function of climate change? Well, all kinds of doubts swirl around that. Same thing with the polar vortex, etc. Whereas when it comes to the environmental problems caused by increasing human population and per capita consumption, it's right before your eyes. All you have to do is look out the window and see the infrastructure expanding and the manufactured capital expanding and the buildings being built and the roads getting more crowded and the pollution problems becoming more insurmountable. And climate change itself is very much a matter of constantly pushing for GDP growth in a fossil-fueled economy. But one last thing about that is, even if we were miraculously able to fuel our economy without fossil fuels, it would be, in terms of biodiversity conservation, for example, it would be like having a bigger gun to shoot ourselves in the foot with. Because when you look at the causes of species endangerment, it's like a who's who of the American economy.
What do you say to those who claim there is no conflict between economic growth and environmental protection?
Well, I would say better lay off the green Kool-Aid, because the conflict is very well established now in the scientific literature. You look at, once again, the causes of species endangerment. And that's, when we think about environmental protection, right on the front lines, we think about other species. We think about how many of them are becoming threatened and endangered. They're sort of like the canaries in the coal mine of the environment. And when you look at those causes of endangerment, it's agriculture, it's logging, it's mining, it's commercial fishing, it's manufacturing, from the heaviest sectors all the way up to the lightest. It's the service sectors, the transportation, the entertainment footprint, the financial services that grease the skids for all these other physical activities. And there's the so-called information economy that's supposed to dematerialize things. Well, that was always greenwashing, because, of course, what's the information going to be used for? And if it's not going to be used for all those other non-information sectors, well, it's fine, but it's not going to be relevant to growing the economy. That information is purchased by corporations and businesses in general for purposes of more and more production and consumption.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Brian Check, founder of the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy, or CASE, and author of the book Supply Shock: Economic Growth at the Crossroads and the Steady State Solution. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Would you comment on the value of the gross domestic product, or GDP, and your suggestion that the GDP is a good indicator of environmental destruction?
So gross domestic product is a measure of production of goods and services in the aggregate and the expenditure on that production, and therefore it reflects the real economy, you know. And the real economy is structured, as an ecologist might put it, it has a trophic structure. It's got a foundation that is required for all of the rest of the economic activity to occur. And the foundation is agricultural and extractive surplus that frees the hands for the division of labor unto all of the other economic activities, all the way to the keyboard in the information sectors. So if you want a growing economy, you have to have at the base more and more agricultural and extractive surplus. And this has been known by economists all the way back to Adam Smith, and even prior to that. That foundation of the economy was well identified and studied. The problem is, during the 20th century, economic growth theory got removed from its foundations in the classical sense, and it took on this production function that says, production is a function of capital and labor, and it leaves out land, because during the development of growth theory, land wasn't a limiting factor. But now, in the 21st century, you know, we have the other situation where land is becoming shortage, land and the resources, and it's hard to find enough of them to feed all of the labor and capital at this point. And GDP, of course, measures the degree of economic activity, and when we realize that that is a matter of how much agro-extractive surplus there is, then it shows you that it's a good measure of the environmental impact.
Historically, in the United States, who has been in favor of a steady-state economy? What support for a steady-state economy has there been in the past?
One way of addressing that is to say that prior to about the 1930s, it's not like there was a lot of explicit push for economic growth. The philosophy was to leave things alone, laissez-faire, as you know, prior to the Great Depression and the general theory put forth by John Maynard Keynes. That changed the nature of academic and social and governmental and political thought toward macroeconomics. And once that occurred in the 1930s, then all of a sudden the government became involved in stimulating the economy to grow. And GDP, of course, became the measure of that growth. Later in the century, there have been advocates for steady state economics. The figure that we tend to think of firstly and foremost is Herman Daly, and he wrote the seminal articles and books in the 60s and 70s about steady-state economics. And since then, especially in the field of ecological economics, you know, we have developed much of the corollaries and nuances pertaining to what's required for a steady-state economy.
What is needed for a steady-state revolution in the 21st century?
In terms of the steady-state revolution, if you will, the political paradigm shift away from economic growth to a steady-state economy, I think there are two general categories of things required. One is reform in consumers' attitudes. So you might look at it as coming from the demand side. What we need is a society that recognizes that reckless consumption is, well, it's becoming sort of a form of questionable citizenship. It's not something that shows consideration for posterity. And then from the supply side, if you will, there are also public policy reforms required to have a smoothly running government and fiscal and financial system in the context of a steady state economy. And, you know, that would start, frankly, with an amendment to the Full Employment Act to be a full and sustainable employment act. And then once the correct goal of a steady state economy is identified, there are all kinds of fiscal and monetary levers and buttons that are currently set for 3% GDP growth, and those just have to be gradually ratcheted back to a stabilized, steady state economy.
In your book, you say that the Endangered Species Act is the prescription for a steady state economy. Would you explain?
This stemmed from my PhD research in the 90s. By the way, I got my earlier graduate education in Seattle, and I kind of missed the good old days, and I missed the Pacific Northwest. But then I went on to try to broaden my conservation work to biodiversity conservation at large. The way I got into that was to take a minor in political science. I did this policy analysis of the Endangered Species Act, and so I analyzed every single word of that act with a fine-tooth comb. And in the ESA, the first sentence contains the phrase that Congress finds and declares that species have been rendered extinct as a consequence of economic growth. Now, it goes on from there to sort of muddy the waters a little bit, but it starts right out recognizing that trade-off between economic growth and species conservation. And then it prescribes policies to prevent the extinction of species, including things like designating critical habitat. If the policy was followed to a T, if it had real teeth, what we would find is that little by little across the landscape, projects would be disallowed. The permits wouldn't be issued for a dam here or a power development there, a road system the other place. Those things would stop happening, and the rest of that green space, to put it loosely, would be left for species. So what you'd wind up is sort of a balance of nature. You'd have the human economy plateauing at a certain level, and then you'd have the non-human economy of nature operating without extinction.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Brian Check, founder of the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy, or CASE, and author of the book Supply Shock: Economic Growth at the Crossroads and the Steady State Solution. Would you comment on the importance of population stabilization for a steady state economy, and also the best approaches to population stabilization?
Yes, two very distinct questions, because technically, of course, population stability is a prerequisite for a steady state economy, and therefore it's a prerequisite for a sustainable economy, and it's a prerequisite to prevent the Malthusian outcomes that would otherwise occur if there was no stoppage to the growth of the human population. Now, the approach to stabilizing the population, well, you know, obviously we can look around the world and see relatively non-efforts in many areas and then draconian efforts such as those of China, especially in some of the previous decades with the one-child policy. So population stabilization in the U.S., for example, I think has to be approached not from head-on. I think first we have to recognize the perils of trying to perpetually grow the GDP, the conflict between GDP growth and a number of things that go approximately in this order: environmental protection, economic sustainability, national security, and international stability. All of those things are imperiled by pulling out all the stops for more and more GDP. Once that is recognized, that perpetually trying to grow GDP is a threat not just to the environment, but to our own kids and grandkids and their economy and the national security, well, then the conversation starts to get serious about, oh, okay, so now what do we actually do to stabilize GDP at a sustainable level? And then, of course, population stabilization plops right out of the bag as something that we have to talk about very seriously. In the U.S., it's not really a huge issue because we're fairly close to a sustainable replacement rate in terms of the citizenry of the country. Obviously, there's an immigration issue that is an extremely difficult, thorny issue to deal with. But like I write about in Supply Shock, it would make the U.S. look greedy. The U.S. would be greedy if it was constantly pursuing GDP growth and at the same time shut its borders down to immigration. The only way to have immigration reform that is aligned with finally stabilizing population in the U.S. is to first adopt the steady state economy as a policy goal, because that will be acceptable in international diplomacy.
How would employment work in a steady state economy? Could there be full employment?
Well, you know, only if we get at it soon enough. That's the problem here. One of the biggest frustrations to me is that why weren't there radio shows back in the 60s and 70s that got heavily into this while there was a lot more breathing room, if you will? Now, you're right, you know, we're pushing the capacity of the country and the planet at the global level so tightly that it will be hard to maintain full employment, even if population stabilized right now. But in a steady state economy, you know, that's your only hope for relatively permanent full employment, because if you're constantly trying to grow the economy, you eventually, due to that structure of the economy based on its agro-extractive surplus, eventually you're going to be liquidating the natural capital, the aquifers. Like, we're liquidating the Ogallala Aquifer in the Central Plains right now, in the Central California aquifers. That's the lifeblood of the economy, and that's being liquidated in our pursuit of perpetual growth. And so what we're doing is we're taking away the jobs, the full employment of the next generation. And so I think that's the more important question to ask, to the extent that we care about the kids and their kids.
What would economic equity look like in a steady state economy?
Now, that'll get you a lot of different answers. And because of that, I made a proposal in Supply Shock that I think would resonate with a lot of people, which is, let's cap the discrepancy in incomes in any given sector, at least, at a 15 times quotient. So if you're a barber, there shouldn't be another barber, certainly in your city, probably not in your state, probably not in the country, that makes more than 15 times as much as you do given an equal work week. If you're a welder, there shouldn't be a welder that makes more than 15 times. And, you know, we have an excellent example for this, and you Seattleites, I think, would like this right at the moment, given that they just won the Super Bowl. You have an NFL. On the one hand, it's a crazy example because it's way unsustainable in terms of the per capita income, but they do have a salary cap, and the principle is the same. That's the type of thing that could be instituted sector by sector, so you wouldn't have these outrageous and seemingly unlimited CEO salaries.
What most stands in the way of moving towards a steady state economy?
That's a tough one. There are a lot of really key things. From an academic standpoint, it's probably that landless production function that every econ student has to digest, which, as I alluded to earlier, it ignores land as a key factor of production. And so what happens then is that leaves the doors open for very, very fuzzy notions of green growth and dematerializing the economy. And so when we get into the public sector at large and we get into that political rhetoric that there is no conflict between growing the economy and protecting the environment, I think that's probably the single biggest problem, is that that rhetoric is so widespread, and it's not even a partisan rhetoric. It's bipartisan or nonpartisan. You hear politicians of all stripes. If they want to get elected, they'll tell you can have your cake and eat it too. And unfortunately, they're kind of empowered to utter that fallacious rhetoric because our conventional economics has that very ecologically depauperate curriculum.
What can we do as individuals to bring about a steady state economy?
Well, once again, you can help bring it about from the demand side and from the supply side. If you're a conspicuous consumer, well, there's a lot of room for you to temper that consumption and therefore lighten your ecological footprint. From the supply side, we can start demanding that rhetoric, that win-win rhetoric, that you can have your cake and eat it too, we want to hold politicians accountable for that. They shouldn't be saying it. It's a lie. At this point in history, there is plenty of scientific, rigorous, peer-reviewed journal articles and books that describe in tremendous detail the fundamental conflict between growing the economy and protecting the environment. And so everybody out there can demand a halt to that very destructive rhetoric, and then can, on the other side of the same coin, start seeking out the politicians that tell it like it is about that trade-off they face between growth today and the sustainability of tomorrow's economy. And some of the best and the brightest politicians are looking at this and thinking about ways to adjust fiscal and monetary policy back toward more of a steady state. And that's the type of political behavior that we need to reward.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I think it's just that there's nothing scary about transitioning from economic growth to a steady state economy. There's nothing Marxist about it or crazy about it or anti-American about it. The American Constitution, this is something I dwell upon quite a bit in Supply Shock, is that the Constitution is very amenable to a steady state economy. But at any point in history, pursuant to that Constitution, you have to have a democratic rider that's smart enough to ride the capitalist horse at a sustainable speed. And so we're not calling for a Politburo and a centrally planned by the government economy. There certainly needs to be a free market in basic marketable goods, you know, loaves of bread and the utensils for eating food and all the little marketable rival and excludable goods and services, as an economist might say. But when it comes to some of the things that we already accept as non-market-able services, like defense, well, we may need to broaden our perspective a little bit in terms of environmental protection and consider that an issue of national security and recognize that we need fiscal and monetary policy reforms that aren't always geared towards stimulating more GDP growth. And then I think we can look forward to a much brighter future.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Brian.
Well, thank you very much, Diane.
You were just listening to Brian Check, founder of the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy, or CASE, and author of the book Supply Shock, Economic Growth at the Crossroads and the Steady State Solution, published in 2013 by New Society Publishers. For more information, check on the web at supplyshock.org. Again, that's supplyshock.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM and kexp.org.